Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, who separates the rhetoric from the reality of Barack Obama's foreign policy over the last 3.5 years. Author and activist Kevin Gray, who examines President Obama and the Democratic Party's aversion to confronting the nation's rising level of poverty. And Bill Dusing of the Connecticut Northeast Organic Farming Association, who takes a critical look at a recent Stanford University study that questions the nutritional benefit of organic foods. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Cheap Chinese-manufactured arms, such as assault rifles and ammunition, have flooded conflict zones in sub-Saharan Africa, while Chinese diplomats work to undercut United Nations arms embargoes in nations such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Among arms exporters to Africa, China has been the most aggressive in challenging UN authority to monitor and restrict arms sales, especially in Darfur, the violence-torn western district of Sudan. UN arms investigators found Chinese-made explosive cartridges in Darfur that were produced 5 years after the UN imposed an arms embargo against Sudan. Former UN weapons inspector David Albright told the Washington Post, "This is really a case of unbridled capitalism, and I think the Chinese government is not always even aware of what these companies are doing." According to a recent study by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, Chinese arms make up 25% of all arms sales to sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa. At the same time, China has advocated for budget cuts targeting UN arms monitors, which makes it difficult for UN inspectors to travel to conflict zones. Beijing diplomats were embarrassed last fall when the Toronto Globe and Mail reported that Chinese arms suppliers had negotiated a deal with officials of the Muammar Gaddafi regime in Libya after China had voted to impose sanctions against Libya in the UN Security Council. Former military criminal investigator Myla Haider ran into constant roadblocks while pursuing rape cases in the military. Many local commanders did not take claims of sexual abuse seriously. Despite repeated attempts to press charges against sexual abusers, only 8% of known sexual assaults in the military are prosecuted, far below the level of prosecution in civil courts. According to the Christian Science Monitor, little seems to have changed since the 1991 Tailhook affair, where hundreds of soldiers at a Las Vegas convention groped and assaulted female soldiers. In April, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta pledged to prosecute more sexual offenders. The Pentagon later set up a new special victims unit to investigate cases of sexual assault. A 2012 scandal at the Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, where nearly 50 female trainees were victimized, revealed the difficulties in prosecuting sexual predators. Thus far, only 6 instructors have been charged with adultery and rape. Documentary filmmaker Kirby Fox, who has interviewed dozens of rape victims in the military, says women are victimized a second time when the Pentagon fails to act against perpetrators of sexual assault. Fox says that the Pentagon should, quote, educate and teach values of respect for women. Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act is a key tool for the expansion of voting rights, and the law played an important role in blocking recent state voter suppression legislation, such as restrictive photo ID laws and reduced hours for early voting. In Texas, the powers in Section 5 were employed to overturn congressional redistricting maps when they were judged to be discriminatory against African Americans and Latinos. But new legal challenges to the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court may undercut the anti-discrimination law. Currently, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act applies to Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. It also covers selected areas of Florida, New York, and California. The original Voting Rights Act gave the U.S. Justice Department powers to challenge voter literacy tests in areas where less than 50% of eligible voters are registered. In 1975, the Act's powers were expanded to enable challenges to election materials printed only in English in districts where a significant minority does not speak English. A recent majority opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts opened the door to new legal challenges to key sections of the Voting Rights Act. Legal petitions, backed by the Conservative Project on Fair Representation, claim that the Voting Rights Act is being used to create new gerrymandered districts favoring racial minorities. Now, many legal observers expect the Roberts Court will soon strike down the anti-discrimination enforcement powers in Section 5. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Senator Barack Obama campaigned for the presidency in 2008 as the hope and change candidate on domestic as well as foreign policy issues. After years of growing disenchantment and opposition to President George W. Bush's bellicose and militaristic policies abroad, including the invasion of Iraq based on false allegations, many Americans were ready for our government to take a new approach in dealing with the rest of the world. But once elected to office, President Obama has continued to pursue many of the same military and national security policies that made his predecessor one of the most unpopular presidents in recent decades. There's been widespread disappointment among progressive activists and younger voters to President Obama's unfulfilled promises, including his failure to close the U.S. Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba, continued dragnet warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens, targeted assassinations of suspected terrorists, an increase in drone attacks, resulting in civilian death and injury in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and other nations, and aggressive prosecution of U.S. government whistleblowers. Your reporter spoke with John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and author of Crusade 2.0, The West Resurgent War on Islam. He separates the rhetoric from the reality of Barack Obama's foreign policy over the last 3.5 years, while assessing GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney's embrace of President Bush's team of neocon architects of the post-9/11 war on terrorism.
Well, as a candidate, Barack Obama clearly wanted to distinguish himself not only from George W. Bush, the record of George W. Bush, but he wanted to distinguish himself from the Republican Party and John McCain, and even wanted to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton, his main rival during the primary. And one way of doing that, at least on foreign policy, was to present himself as being a much more moderate, much more diplomacy-oriented candidate, someone who would reach out to America's adversaries if they were interested in negotiating, and negotiate in turn. This was a kind of stance that was ridiculed by Hillary Clinton as being naive, and certainly the Republican Party tried to make it seem as though this upstart senator had no experience in foreign policy, didn't know what he was talking about, and would be dangerous once if elected. And what we saw when Barack Obama was ultimately elected was that we saw a definite shift in tone. Under Barack Obama, the U.S. foreign policy became distinctly more conciliatory, again, rhetorically. You saw, for instance, the retiring of the phrase global war on terror. You saw the new president try to close the facility in Guantanamo. You saw relatively rapidly a commitment to ending the war in Iraq. You saw a speech in favor of nuclear abolition. And you saw a speech in Cairo in favor of transformation of U.S. relationship with the Muslim world. All of that was, of course, to the better, and many people responded here in the United States and internationally with a sigh of relief. Here we had someone who said he was going to do these things as candidate and proceeded to do so, again, rhetorically, as president. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, Barack Obama was not able to translate that rhetoric into policy. In some cases, it was a function of considerable pushback that he encountered from Republicans, some pushback he encountered internationally, and in some cases it was more a function of his lack of commitment in some sense to these issues, or rather a misinterpretation of his commitment to these issues on the part of observers.
One of the disappointments for many progressive activists around the country since Barack Obama became president was his shift from his pronouncements before he got into the White House, that he was going to honor the Constitution and ensure that civil liberties were protected. Unlike his predecessor, George W. Bush, when he got into office, he seemed to forget all those commitments and pledges and continued many of the surveillance policies, did not close the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base Detention Center, and kept Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan open. That was really a black hole for many prisoners.
Well, again, we expected a different conduct on the part of the president for a couple of reasons. One, his statements as a candidate. Two, because he was a lawyer, and a lawyer who specialized in the Constitution. We expected him to be a little bit more careful in observing the letter of the Constitution. So there was considerable disappointment. Now, some of the reasons are understandable. I mean, he clearly wanted to close Guantanamo. His first act, basically, as president, signing the closure of that base, but he encountered considerable political resistance. I mean, the Republicans, you know, had decided that they were going to oppose the president basically down the line on virtually every policy effort. We also saw, however, an even greater disappointment, perhaps, the increase in the use of extrajudicial murder. Here we have a president who is essentially acting as the judge, the jury, and the executioner. He has some advice on this, of course, but ultimately he is the one who is making the decisions about who the United States is assassinating overseas, including U.S. citizens.
Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney is really proposing a throwback to the George W. Bush administration foreign policy, surrounding himself with the neoconservatives that were the policymakers for G.W. Bush. Many people are disappointed with Obama and his performance as president in foreign policy, but certainly when you compare it to Mitt Romney, there are many progressives that wouldn't choose Romney's path either.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. If Obama's foreign policy is characteristic of, say, the second term of George W. Bush, in which we did see, you know, some softening of the Bush approach in foreign policy, Mitt Romney would be a throwback to the first half of the Bush term. In other words, the hard power confrontation of other countries. Mitt Romney insists on increasing military spending, even though the Pentagon itself has said it can do with less. He proposes a more confrontational stance toward Russia. He would probably be a little bit more hostile toward China. You know, Mitt Romney, at least as a candidate, in here he's, you know, trying to distinguish himself from the traditional notion of the Democratic Party as softer on national security issues, is definitely trying to present himself as being a much harder line hawk. And the people that he's collected around him as advisors are considerably worse when it comes to foreign policy. At least they're far more hard line in their militarist orientation.
That was John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Crusade 2.0, The West's Resurgent War on Islam. Learn more about foreign policy issues in this year's presidential election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Observers of the issues discussed in countless speeches and demographic groups targeted at the Democratic and Republican national conventions could easily conclude that the primary focus of both parties' presidential election campaigns through November will be an all-out effort to appeal to middle-class voters. While politicians from both parties address the anemic economic recovery that has created a sense of uncertainty among many working families across the nation, little was said at either convention about the deepening poverty that is undermining the fabric of many of the nation's poorest communities. Double-digit unemployment rates now afflict both African Americans and Latinos. Census Bureau statistics for 2011, due to be released in mid-September, are predicted to show that the nation's poverty rate has reached its highest level in 46 years, with up to 15.7% of the population now living below the official poverty line. Although the worst recession since the Great Depression has exacerbated the nation's poverty level, a general trend toward greater income inequality across the country in recent decades has seen the poverty rate steadily rise since 2000. Alarmingly, child poverty rates have increased from 15% in 1970 to 20% in 2010. While a relatively small number of protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, demonstrated in the streets to draw attention to the plight of the poor, continuing record numbers of home foreclosures, and the lack of attention by either party, their message was largely ignored by the nation's news media. Your reporter spoke with writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Here he examines the Democratic Party's aversion to confronting the nation's rising levels of poverty.
Well, you know, we're in the era of the idea that the poor are poor because they want to be poor. And, of course, people talk about, well, why aren't the poor organized, or why don't the poor demand more? Well, when you're poor, it's really hard to get to go to meetings. It's really hard to even pay for membership in meetings. You're trying to just survive day to day. And there are not many organizations that take on the political organization of the poor. And where we're looking at a campaign season where race and racism are the primary weapons used to diminish candidates, and we're talking about Obama in particular, you know, Obama's going to stay away from this idea of taking on the issues of the poor, because Republicans are running ads on welfare in some of the swing states. And this whole strategy of the Republican Party, from Gingrich talking about the food stamp president to Santorum talking about blacks want to get something for nothing, to Romney going to the NAACP and kind of regurgitating Santorum's slander, it's all about race and appealing to a particular group of voters, and that's white voters, and in particular white male voters with both parties.
In exploring the whole issue of President Obama and the Democrats generally avoiding issues of discussion of poverty and how this country should address it, part of the equation there is the political strategy saying that the constituencies, the poor people in this country, working families who are struggling, really have nowhere else to go. So they target all the political advertising and attention to white working class voters and so-called independent on-the-fence voters, leaving those issues off the table. It seems very cynical, of course, that you're just going to ignore your base voters because they've got nowhere else to go. But that's, in essence, what's been going on.
I mean, there's always another choice. It's just not a good one. You cannot vote, which a lot of people have made that choice. They've decided that it really doesn't matter who's in office. And if you look at the unemployment rate for African Americans, you know, the Democrats want to run this message that we are better off now with Obama in office as compared to 4 years ago. And maybe we don't have a war in Iraq that we see every day, although people are still dying every day. And we're still spending an untold amount of money on contractors in Iraq every day. Maybe we don't have that. But, you know, on the domestic front, unemployment in the black community is probably somewhere between 15 and 20%. It keeps increasing. And we're still facing a home mortgage foreclosure crisis. And the wealth gap is growing for a lot of people, but for black people in particular. But with this idea of racial solidarity and with this attack on Obama because of his race, black folk in particular take racist attacks on Obama as an attack on black competency. So you're almost forced to vote or defend him because you're defending his competence.
After the election, Kevin Gray, there's something called sequestration and a lot of discretionary domestic spending on the chopping block. There has been discussion before between Barack Obama and the Republicans about some kind of grand bargain where the targets are set on diminishing our social safety net programs, a bipartisan effort where an agreement like that, although it failed before, could be reached after this election. What concerns do you have if Barack Obama is reelected and he moves to that place that he was at a bunch of months ago, trying to make compromise with the Republicans?
Well, you know, what has to happen if Obama should win re-election, and knowing that he would have nothing to lose, he is a privatizer and a corporatist. People need to understand that. You know, this idea of charter schools and privatizing the public schools, that's a big issue. And that's something we got to be mindful of. And people kind of went along with Obama for the first term because, as I said, the optics of who he was, racial solidarity, had no place else to go, wanted to see him get to that second term. But now the threat or the stick moving forward would have to be waved at those legislators that would vote for any grand bargain that wouldn't be in our interest. So it's about us organizing to educate people about the threat that some of the proposed suggestions or in Simpson-Bowles, such as raising the retirement age to 69, we've got to educate people on the threats to their future security.
That was writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama. Find links to related articles on poverty and politics on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A September 4th headline in the New York Times read, "Stanford scientists cast doubt on advantages of organic meat and produce." The study cited was a meta-analysis of 40 years of research on organic and conventionally produced produce, that is, produce sprayed with pesticides. The study concluded that organic food was no more nutritious than non-organic. The research didn't focus on questions of sustainability or even of flavor, though many people who responded to the article stated these issues were paramount in their decision to pay a premium price to buy organic food. While the Stanford study, conducted by the university's Center for Health Policy, concluded that organic fruits and vegetables on average had no more nutritional value than their conventionally grown counterparts, the research did find that organic produce retained fewer traces of pesticides and meat was less contaminated by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Dusing, president of the Connecticut chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. He's also president of the NOFA Interstate Council, representing New England states Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont, as well as New York and New Jersey. Here he discusses the reasons people farm organically and shop for organic food, as well as the forces opposing an upcoming California referendum that would mandate the labeling of genetically modified foods.
Nutrition isn't the main reason that most people eat organic food. It is not the reason that farmers want to grow organic food. There are a whole lot of other reasons, but it did find clearly that there were fewer pesticides and then also fewer antibiotic-resistant bacteria in organic food. So there's two very good things and one thing that wasn't a whole lot different. And organic is a holistic practice, and we do it because of the way we care for the earth. It's working with nature instead of fighting nature. I don't think there was any reasonable conclusion, but some people obviously took it and ran with it. The industrial food system is very worried about all the interest in local, organic, and sustainable, because the industrial food system is not that. It's not organic, it's very dangerous for the planet, and it's certainly unsustainable. But there is this incredible effort on their part through things like the Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, through the work of the Farm Bureau, through the work of the people who are fighting the labeling of GMOs in California. If you look at that list, you see who's on the other side of this food fight. You know, Monsanto and DuPont and Coca-Cola and General Mills and PepsiCo and, you know, the industrial food system, and there's an ecological food system. And, you know, the industrial food system wants to work against nature and wants to, as much as possible, poo-poo any interest in local or organic. And they keep trumping up these studies and then giving them lots of publicity to try to discourage people from thinking about the food in a way that is healthier for them and healthier for our planet.
You know, the meta-analysis also didn't evaluate any taste differences between organic and conventionally grown food, which must be hard to test for anyway. But a lot of people who commented on the study have indicated they prefer the taste of organic foods.
You know, they're either organic because they don't want to eat pesticides, which was shown on this study to be the case, and they eat organic because it tastes good, because maybe it makes them feel good about the relationship with the farmer and the farm workers who aren't being doused with chemicals in order to produce what is nutritious for us.
Several state legislatures have tried unsuccessfully to require labeling of foods containing GMOs. Now California has put the issue on the ballot in a referendum this November. What does it call for exactly?
As I understand it, it would require foods that contain ingredients that have been produced by genetic engineering to be labeled. And I think unless it's changed, and I doubt if it has, it doesn't say anything about meat, animals, and what they've eaten. Most of the animals in this country eat genetically modified grain. The jury's still out, I think, about whether that's beneficial to the animals or whether it has some effect on us.
So to be certified organic, food can't contain any GMOs, right?
Yes. That's the one way now you can avoid genetically modified organisms is by buying certified organic food.
I read a book recently by Stuart Brand, who produced the Whole Earth Catalogs. It's called Whole Earth Discipline, and he sort of takes on nuclear power and GMOs and a lot of other things that were sort of gospel on the left, where he used to be, and he does his best to debunk them all. And I thought the piece on GMOs was the strongest case he made, that there's a lot of advantages to genetically modified crops, higher production, weed control. How bad do you think GMOs are?
Oh, I think they are awful. I'm not saying that they never could have a place in our food system, but as they are now, they're designed to do one of two things. One is to resist doses of Roundup, massive doses, in order to control the weeds, and that system isn't working. Nature doesn't stand still. If you spray weeds with the same herbicide year after year after year, the weeds become resistant, or the resistant weeds begin to thrive. And so that's what's happened. There's a lot of problems with super weeds where they've used these Roundup-ready crops. It has been said that Roundup is a relatively benign herbicide, and it was better to use it once, which is what they thought might happen, than to use these other more toxic herbicides. What's happening, the Roundup's not working now, so they're developing corn and probably soybeans that are resistant to more toxic herbicides, including 2,4-D, which was part of Agent Orange. In terms of what it does to the soil and the way it ties up minerals, it has encouraged various exotic viruses and diseases to come into the corn crop because of the way it doesn't make the minerals available. It changes the soil ecosystem. So we need to learn to work with nature, and nature works by creating biodiversity.
That was Bill Dusing, president of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association. For more information on organic foods in reaction to the Stanford University study, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.